Right, let's say good morning now to Louise McSherry, coordinator of the Human Milk Bank and a former breast milk donor. Good morning to you. Good to have you back on the show, Louise. How are you?
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
Right, now, we all know how vital early nutrition is for our children, and for some of our most vulnerable babies, breast milk is quite simply a lifeline, and it's packed with antibodies, essential nutrients, and everything a tidy body needs to grow strong and healthy, and that's the focus of our Wellness Wednesday today. Louise, are you asking people who are breastfeeding, or if they're a breastfeeding mother with a healthy supply, or perhaps they recently stopped breastfeeding and have some milk stored, to that it can go to good use?
Absolutely, Greg. A lot of mums find that they may have a good supply of milk when they're breastfeeding their baby. And as you say, when they have ceased breastfeeding, they may have a stock supply. And what we're appealing to mums for is to donate that milk to the only milk bank in Ireland, which is here in Enniskillen. We then donate that milk, we pasteurise that milk and send it out to neonatal units all over the island of Ireland to help neonatal babies get the best start in life.
And how important is that donated milk to those babies in the circumstances you described there?
It's so important, Greg. Babies really, really prematurely need the best start for their gut, their immune system, their eye and brain development. The research is there over many, many years to just outline the benefits of this early, early breast milk for these premature babies. And they really depend on this milk to get the best start. What we have in the milk bank here is an analyzer, which analyzes the nutritional components of our milk, and then we put that out to the neonatal unit so they know exactly the nutritional content for the babies, and they can tailor that. The dietitians in the neonatal units can then tailor that to each specific baby and their specific needs. So it really is capturing all of their nutritional needs that they need at such an early start.
Just when they need it. And it can be the difference between, their survival or not, or how well they develop from there on. Just trying to tease out what may be the barriers for people to do this. A, knowledge. So we're talking about it now, and people might say, right, I have excess, or I have some stored, or indeed I might continue to express and help other mothers. They might. Is there any element of mums maybe being uncomfortable with their milk being given to another baby, or maybe, you know, other mums using donated milk? Is that anything that needs to be overcome? Is there any problem there in people's minds?
Not so much in that aspect, Greg. It's probably more the barriers that mums face is maybe the having the confidence to be able to donate the milk. And what I would always advise is to always keep a supply for your own baby. And after that, think about the milk bank. And some mums find that they have a good supply, and that's established after maybe a number of months. It doesn't have to be straight away when their baby is so young, but after a few months, maybe when the baby is being weaned onto solids, and that they find maybe their supply is there and the demand from their own baby isn't as high, and then they find themselves with a surplus. So it really goes to good use, as I said, and mums can donate milk up until their baby is 12 months old. So if you think about that time frame of how much milk really could be donated over that time. And the other important thing to note is that any donation is really, really appreciated by the milk bank and used. And so mums think that they have to have a certain amount of milk, and that's not the case. We take very, very small amounts in to the milk bank, and because there is so much demand in Ireland with the neonatal babies, we take the smallest amount, and it's used very, very gratefully.
So do you always have a bank of milk available, Louise? You know, I mean, we often sort of say, you know, if we're doing appeals for blood donation, for an example, they would always have blood, but if there was a slowdown in donations, that could be sort of used up very quickly. What's the situation with you guys?
I mean, in an ideal world, the same with the blood donations, we would love to have a bank and to have lots and lots of milk. And we always try to keep a stock level, but we do find at particular times of the year, the stock levels do go that little bit lower in that different holiday periods, people are away. And it's important to note with, apologies, it's just... logged me out here.
No, we can hear you loud and clear. Don't worry about that.
You can hear me. That's great. With holiday periods and with mums maybe ceasing breastfeeding, then we're continually recruiting donors. So when we talk about having a stock level, it's just having enough to go out to the neonatal units, which means continual recruitment of mums as the cycle does end when their baby is 12 months old. So it's just a continual recruitment process of new mums, and then when their babies are 12 months old, that ceases the donation period.
So just a couple of basic questions which might help people make the decision. So mums probably already know, but how do you store your milk, and for how long can you store it? You talked about building up quite a supply over a period of time. So how are mums storing their milk, and how long is it good for?
Yeah, so we will send out a screening form and a couple of health questions, and we will send out a lot of guidance with that on how to express and store the milk. And the milk can stay in the freezer at home with the mum for a period of 3 months before it reaches our shelves. When it reaches our shelves, we pasteurise the milk and send it off for microbiological testing. And then it has a shelf life of 6 months. So that's when it goes out to the neonatal units. But really, over the span of the breastfeeding journey, the mum can donate milk from her supply is established right up to the baby is 12 months old. So.
And is that because of the nutritional value changes after 12 months, is it?
Absolutely. It was at one stage up until the baby was 9 months old, and then we did do a trial until the baby was 12 months old, and we found that the nutritional components didn't particularly change in a way that it was going to affect our milk in that way, and our nutritional components were still within the acceptable limits. So we have extended that to 12 months. But yes, certainly after the 12-month mark, the nutritional value of the milk just wouldn't be parameters that we need for the neonatal units.
So, and all of this will be discussed with mums, of course, but logistically, how is the milk gotten from point A to point B being yourselves?
Yeah, so we rely on volunteer blood bikers, and they will meet mums at their nearest hospital. And that's a completely volunteer service that we rely on. And we're so, so grateful to the blood bikers who meet the mums at their nearest hospital. And whilst keeping the cold chain of the milk being frozen, it's brought to ourselves, and then it's brought through the pasteurising process here. So although we collect milk from mums all over the island of Ireland, we're not asking them to drive a great distance. We have our volunteers, who we're so, so grateful for, who will meet the mums and bring the milk to ourselves.
All right. And the amount of families that you've helped is huge. Last year, the Enniskillen Southwest Acute Hospital helped support neonatal units across 27 hospitals. And how many premature babies were you able to help or provide milk for?
I apologise, Greg. I should
have 700. Here. I was 700.
I think we're talking in the region of over 700.
Yep, 783 premature babies. 223 were either twins or triplets. Sorry, I didn't mean to cross that
you're
on
you're absolutely
there.
Fine. So with the figure being over 1,000 litres of milk, that's our target is always to have as much milk as possible sent out. But we do rely on the donors, of course, to bring that milk in, which we're so, so grateful for. And then it's sent out to all of the units. And it's always a lovely story when you get a mum coming back to us wanting to donate her milk because her baby has benefited from the donor milk, and that's always a lovely story. So that brings it right back to home, how precious it is.
Okay, we have the contact details here. I'll just in case you had a pen anticipating them, you can call from the Republic 048 686 28 333, but give us a call. We have the number, and you all know our number off by heart, I'm sure, listeners. Or tmb.swah@westerntrust.hscni.net. That's the email. Again, I suggest that we'll link that on our Facebook pages or give it to you over the phone rather than you try and write all of that down. Louise, I hope this triggers a couple of people, if they can, to assist the brilliant work that yous are doing there. It really is amazing. It really is amazing. And you don't know half the time what's going on. And I was aware that the blood bike guys and girls have a big role in this as well. And it really takes a community, doesn't it, at times?
It really does. And I think people will be really, really shocked when they hear that this is the only milk bank in Ireland, and it's in little old Enniskillen. And we just work away behind the scenes like little elves, but without our donors, we're so indebted to them. Without our donors, we don't have milk. So we're really, really grateful to every mum who gets in touch with us and becomes a donor. So I just want to say thanks as well to the mums who have donated. They're what keeps the service going. So you can find us on the Western Trust Facebook and by the email or the phone number. So thank you so much, Greg.
We'll share that out here and retain it as well. Listen, thanks so very much, Louise. That's Louise McSherry, who's coordinator of the Human Milk Bank and a former breast milk donor herself. And as she say, what a beautiful thing is whereby, you know, a mum has received another mother's milk for her baby who's in need and then becomes a donor themselves, which is the perfect sort of circle of it, isn't it? Between all of those donating to the Enniskillen Southwest Acute Hospital Service, they've supported neonatal units across 27 hospitals right across the country. And that life-saving donor milk has helped 783 premature babies, of which 223 were either twin, a twin, or a triplet. And just when those babies need that milk is like gold dust, miracle dust, so to speak. All right, if you want those numbers or the email address, give us a call. You know, we're 07491 25000. We say it all of the time. And just ask and we'll pass that info on to you. And often with items like that, you might get a call in the afternoon or 2 or 3 days later. People hear it on a podcast, or they didn't hear it directly and they heard it from someone else. And generally speaking, we get to gather up a few donors, which is great. Hi, Greg. Can you get a massive shout out to Marty from the V&M podcast, who marries his beautiful wife-to-be, Aisling, this Friday? Hope they have a lifetime of happiness from the team at the V&M podcast, Vinny, Jason and Mark. P.S. This is a plug for the podcast, which can be got on YouTube and Instagram. More than a shout out to Marty and Aisling. Well, listen, Marty and Aisling, have a wonderful, wonderful day on Friday. The most recent guest on the VMM podcast is our own Brendan Devaney. And he sat down with the boys for a good while. I haven't got a chance to listen to it yet, but Brendan's pretty much an open book, and I'm sure it's going to make for pretty good listening. Prior to that, it was Jason Quigley. I think prior to that, it was me. There might have been one or two in between. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, lads, take a break, or at least have a episode in the bag so that Marty and Aisling can enjoy their nuptials and everything that comes thereafter. All right, check them out, by the way, on YouTube and other platforms as well. They're very active on the likes of Instagram. Now, another incident of a local Link bus service being disrupted because of inappropriate parking. There was a post put up yesterday, Route 973. The 973 is unable to serve Fannet Lighthouse for the rest of today. That was yesterday, by the way, just to save any confusion. It's not able to get turned with all the cars parked. Serviced will stop at Ballylair. We apologise for any inconvenience. Now, as I say, we had a similar issue last week, and it's turned out that, I mean, obviously, locals, people just going about their everyday business are being held up by bad parking, but it's stopping complete bus services. Councillor Liam Blaney joins us on the programme now, and I suppose, you know, it doesn't help those waiting on the bus, but the Lighthouse has become very popular. It is very popular, and parking is a problem.
Yeah, it's part of trying to get people to the area. And that's, I suppose that's a sign of the success of the Lighthouse in Thanet, that we're having this problem. And the Lighthouse had applied. Well, first of all, the local link bus was having difficulty in getting turning, so they came up with a plan between themselves and the Lighthouse committee and the council that they would try a temporary road closure for a part of it from about 100 metres down from the main gate where you go up onto the Lighthouse, back a bit, and close the road off there, and just allow the bus up to turn where the with no cars parked up there, there would be room for the bus to turn on it. And it had been working, but unfortunately somebody broke the chain was on it.
Mm.
And the bus had to suspend the runs to the Lighthouse. They went as far as by the post office, and the Lighthouse did facilitate anybody that was down there, was going down there, to take them up as far as the Lighthouse again, or as far as the post office again, until they get the chains fixed. And as far as I understand, they're in the process of getting that sorted them out, and hopefully if it gets up again, that will be seen by people, that in case maybe somebody didn't see it and accidentally broke it, we don't know, but...
Yeah, you'd hope it was an accident, but it does sort of open up the conversation again to, you know, parking at our amenities, be it the Lighthouse, be it beaches, you know, and the fact we do have a growing local link service as an example, or just general bus services. There, we need to start looking at this rather than dealing with it in a case-by-case basis, Liam, would you agree?
Well, I suppose a lot of them will have to be dealt with maybe in a case-by-case basis, but there's a car park there as well for the bus could go in and turn, but there's not many cars about there and that as well.
Mm.
They feel it's safer if they could get a place on their own. And this, I believe, will work. And this is a temporary trial for a month to see does it work. And if it does, they're going to try and have something more permanent on it for next year. And hopefully it'll work a lot better. But, you know, we have to try these things out, first of all, to see how do they work and do they work. And this did seem to be working okay, although it was only in the infancy of it for the month. But it's up for the 20th of August that they have a road closure. So hopefully they get it up and sorted, and that people will adhere to it.
Brilliant stuff.
Allow the access of buses and the turning of buses, and even safer for people as visiting the centres or the Lighthouse as well, whenever they're down there, that they don't have to fear about their children being... any danger because of bus turning manoeuvres near to where they're at.
What feedback are you getting from those in the tourism sector, Liam, in the area about how this year's holding up and the hopes for, you know, broad shoulders of the summer season?
Well, I suppose the weather up and mixed, kind of mixed batch, only it has been fairly warm all the time, and it was the feedback I was getting earlier on was quiet. But it seems to be getting busy this last couple of weeks. And as you say, the shoulder of the season now is going to be an important one. Hopefully the weather will improve again for the month of August and September, and it will keep attracting people to the area and to come out and to visit amenities like this.
Yeah, it's like a light switch, isn't it? The sun comes out and next thing you know, the population of an area quadruples. It's astonishing, really, but it is what it is. All right, Liam, thanks very much for that. And hopefully that was an accident.
Great.
And once that chain goes back up, it continues to be successful. That's Councillor Liam Blaney there, 086 60 25,000, if you've got an issue in that regard that you would like to raise. But anyway, by the way, to be absolutely clear, that disruption to the Route 973 was yesterday, but we just thought we'd highlight it today to get that info out there and for us all to be a little bit more considerate of where we park and consider when we're pulling that car in there, is that obstructing a bus getting past? Well, we'd hope not. Madeleine Delaney is Chief Executive of the Charities Regulator, and Madeleine joins us now. Good morning to you. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
We're speaking off the back of a new report that shows 500 concerns were raised about registered Irish charities last year, marking a decrease on the number of concerns raised in 2023. People still know the regulator is there, right? So and they know how to report, I would hope, for the most part. So we can take this, as it appears, to be good news anytime there is a reduction, I presume.
I think so, Greg, and I think it can be down to a number of different factors, but certainly one of them is that people understand that there's a charity regulator, but they also understand what the regulator can and can't look at. But also charities are more aware of regulation and of their obligations, and certainly we see them working very hard on their standards of governance and their compliance with their obligations under the Act. And then there's other variables, and one of them that I think that we have made some inroads on are in relation to unregistered entities calling themselves a charity. And we would have had a lot of complaints about that or concerns raised about that previously. And there's been a drop in those. And again, that's down to people's awareness.
Yeah, might as well remind us to save any popping up. What is the difference between a charity and an entity that might portray itself as a charity? Those are awesome, obvious sort of examples, I suppose.
Well, a charity is only one type of not-for-profit organisation. And to call yourself a charity or lead people to believe you're a charity, you have to be on the register of charities. And to be on the register of charities, you have to meet a test that's set out in the legislation. And essentially that means that you have to be advancing a particular type of charitable purpose and that you have to be doing it for a public benefit. And then if you are a charity, there's certain reporting requirements and standards that you have to meet. So we would urge people who are thinking of giving to an organisation, who have been asked to give to an organisation that say that they are a charity, that they go on to our register, which they can go on to at checkacharity.ie, and they will find out whether they are on the register, and then they can find out certain basic information about that organisation.
So 42% of the concerns raised with you, the regulator, were around charity governance. Does that catch in question marks over whether something is a charity or not, or does it go beyond that?
It goes beyond that in that governance is about the systems and procedures that are in place to control the charity and to make sure that it's carrying out its charitable purpose and the money is being used for that charitable purpose and not for anything else. And the people who are responsible for running the charity and responsible in law are called charity trustees, and they are the volunteers who are either on the board or the committee of the charity, depending on its legal form, and they have responsibility for the administration of the charity. So they have to be sure that they are making the decision-making collectively, that they are making it based on all of the information, and that the finances are being run and controlled in accordance with their direction.
And what do you do with these concerns? Is everyone investigated? Do you often find that maybe there's a campaign of sorts and you get multiple complaints about one particular organisation, or is there a pattern you can talk to us about in that regard?
So sometimes there can be more than one concern raised about a particular organisation, and sometimes we can see that triggered by something on social media that a number of people see, and then they contact us. We will assess the information that we get to make sure that it's just not an allegation, that there are some facts at least grounding it, and we will make inquiries then with the charity. Most charities engage with us on a voluntary basis. We don't really have to use our powers. Sometimes we might have to seek information on foot of a statutory directions. But most charities and charity trustees work very hard at running their charity well and achieving good standards of governance. And our engagement with them can help point out any shortcomings. And most of them work voluntarily with us to resolve those shortcomings and put in place the controls and procedures that I spoke about earlier.
And whilst there's almost 500 concerns, you have to compare that to the amount of charities there are. There are more charities in Donegal than there were concerns nationally. 510 charities in Donegal, making up 11,500 charities right across the country. That's a remarkable figure. But I suppose it puts a bit of context into the amount of concerns raised.
It does indeed. And actually, Donegal has the fourth highest number of charities in the country. And charities vary a huge amount. I mean, it's a very diverse sector. And what you'll find is that over half of those charities are small volunteer-only charities that are providing very valuable services, but also activities and niche activities in the local communities. And they are essential to the fabric of communities at this stage.
And I suppose it's in the best interests of any charity to sort of work with the likes of the regulator, make sure everything's in order, all the T's are crossed, I's are dotted, so that firstly they are compliant, but secondly, if there's any question marks raised, everything becomes apparent really quickly.
That's true, and we have a lot of guidance on our website that we hope assists these charities and charity trustees to do their job. We have a charities governance code which sets out the basic principles that charities need to adhere to. And what we would say to charities and charity trustees is to engage with our website, engage with us, and particularly if we contact you, to just come and work with us. There's nothing to be afraid of. We just want to achieve those good standards of governance so that the charities themselves succeed and can continue to deliver on those charitable activities and services that are so vital.
Is it easy, finally, for you to give us an outline of what kind of actions were taken, if any, over the course of last year or a suitable time frame?
So last year, we would have worked, as we normally do with most charities, on a voluntary basis. And indeed, we closed as many concerns as we opened. So it's like a rolling figure. And as I say, most of that engagement is on a voluntary basis. We do have three investigations open, and they are a more formal engagement with a charity where we appoint inspectors and they set out about finding out the facts in relation to certain issues that have arisen. And they will provide a report to me, which is usually published. And then we further engage with the charities on that. We have had a particular issue, unfortunately, in relation to a very basic obligation on charities, which is to file an annual report with us. And that gives some information on charities' finances and activities for the previous 12 months. And when people go on the register at checkacharity.ie, they can see those details about the charity. But some charities have been a bit slow in filing their annual report, or indeed missing it altogether for a year or more than a year. So we have been engaging with that particular segment of the sector. And in a few instances, we have taken prosecutions. We took 8 prosecutions for failing to file an annual report, including after extensive engagement. And we also removed 38 charities from the register. It would seem that there are a number of entities still on the register that are no longer active, and we're beginning to unearth those through that process. So we're not going around removing charities that are very active and have services ongoing. They are mostly charities that are inactive.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, thanks for all that information. I do appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. That's Madeleine Delaney, Chief Executive of the Charities Regulator. And a caller says, Greg, when I read this morning, I was shocked that Donegal has over 500 charities, 510 in fact. That's 510 groups, they say, that had to supply the work of the government, once again proving that Donegal is forgotten. I wonder, is that a fair enough assessment? Is that the space the charities are sort of filling, so to speak? Hi, Greg. Whilst in Dublin on Sunday, the team bus was coming down the street. I was with my son and he was too small to see. A Donegal guy lifted him up for me so we could see the team. No idea who he is, but please, can you thank the guy who lifted up a little boy to see the bus? True gentleman. Hope he's listening. Thanks from a grateful mum. What a lovely message to send in. Hi, I found a dead rabbit on my driveway this morning. The head was completely missing, but the rest of the body intact. What could have happened? Can you put this to Greg, please? Well, we can put it out to our listeners. It's a bit macabre. I'm not sure if a car might sort of be able to pass it in such a way to leave it in that state, but maybe someone out there can give us some advice. You'd kind of worry about it, finding it in your driveway. How did it end up there? Did someone put it there? Are they having a go? Blah, 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 blah. So I can understand why you might want to seek some listener support in relation to answering those questions. Okay, back with more very shortly. Okay, in studio now with Chris Ashmore, presenter of the Highland Radio Business Matters podcast. Good morning to you, Chris. How are you keeping?
Very good, Greg. Very good.
Let me get you in focus there. Someone slap that. Good to see you. Right, okay. Before we talk about the podcast, which is live really soon, if not now, let's get some news. ISME, the Small and Medium Enterprise Association, a new mentoring program from them. What's this about, Chris?
Yes, well, this is a program that Donegal, its members in Donegal can avail of. It's worth around €2,000. And participants will receive either 2 full days or a number of half days of mentoring with experienced business advisors covering a wide range of topics, and this will be, it's all under, I suppose that the theme is, it's called Stages, so it's Survive, Thrive, Accelerate, Grow, Export and Scale. And the fact that it's free, it may well be of interest to some businesses out there. So contact ISME if you want to engage in that.
All right. Fuel prices for motorists, any good news on the horizon?
Well, at least insofar as prices have steadied, the latest AA monthly fuel price survey showing unleaded petrol last month averaging 173 a litre, and that was down slightly on June. Now, the message is, though, do shop around, because you can get a big variance. Even I know personally, you can get a 10 to 12 cent a litre variance, which, now, some people seem to be quite fussy about this, and some people just go in, they just fill up the car, they don't even look about it. But when you're filling up the full tank, that 10 or 12 cent a litre can amount to quite a lot.
It's a fiver, isn't it? It's a fiver, a tank on a 50 litre fill.
And not only that.
That is far better off in your pocket.
Yeah, not only that. Now we've got the price disparity north and south again. Unleaded, it's about 25 cent a litre cheaper in the north now. So that's, you're saving maybe 10 or 12 euro on a full fill. So the border areas.
It would be interesting to sort of dig into the strategy of, you know, furthest from the borders, that adjust price or location or, you know, overheads or, you know, all the factors that determine the price. I presume it's not, you know, it'd be very easy to say it's all gouging, but it has to, you have to sell a product that fits your business model and your profits and your wages and all that type of stuff. I mean, say, for instance, how is it worth 3 euro to pump your own fuel versus someone else pump it for you?
And then years ago, filling stations were purely just filling stations.
Yep,
whereas now they're invariably, they're all shops. And of course, the margins in fuel can be so low, but it's getting you to go into the shop. Mm-hmm. And then that's where they make the money.
Or in the deli.
And just on that, on the fuel prices, the EV charging, so the survey takes that into account, the fuel prices by the AA. No change in the at-home costs, but if you're going to the ESB e-car charge points that you may see around the county, now there's an increase there. They're going up from 59 cent a kilowatt hour to 66 cents. So that's a 7 cent. Yeah. So, you know, not insignificant.
Do we know what a kilowatt might equate to, Chris? Don't want to put you on the spot.
I don't know that. If I had an electric car, maybe I would know that instantly.
As I would too. Yeah. I wouldn't have had to ask. Indeed. Right, now, TU Dublin, it might seem somewhat removed from where we are, but that doesn't matter because their most latest course is an online course. Who's it for and what's it about?
Yes, now this is an online course for people with disabilities who maybe are interested in starting their own business, and maybe access and transport could be an issue for them. This begins in September. It's backed by AIB. The course is free of charge. It's 12 interactive online sessions, and there'll be guest speakers, and you'll get access to the Technological University of Dublin's full range of student supports and resources. Applications are open, but they must be submitted by this Thursday, and there's only 20 places available initially. But there's a possibility, if this takes off, it'll be something that we'll see more of again. So good initiative.
Okay, good stuff. Any notes for our diary?
Just a couple of things. Obviously, August, a quiet enough month, but if you want to think ahead a bit, there's a Start Your Own Business program beginning on the 2nd of September, when we'll be getting back into that sort of autumn routine. That'll be over 8 weeks, just 25 euro through your local enterprise office. And if you have an idea for a food or drink manufacturing business, the Food Starter Program, also on in September. You can contact the local enterprise office on that. And by the way, there is a business support clinic in Bundoran coming this Friday, the 1st of August. So more details again from the local enterprise office.
Rightio. Now, let's get to this week's podcast. And one of your guests, Garrett Hart.
Yeah, Reformman Garrett Hart, a multi-award-winning media executive. Very keen musician, of course, as well. He was for many years the editor-in-chief of News Talk, so dealt with a lot of people at a high level. Several years ago, he actually left News Talk and founded Heart Media, which is a communications and PR agency in Dublin, has won a number of awards. And in the programme, we'll hear about Heart Media. And also, I've been speaking to him, and we have a clip here, about the Donegal Dublin Business Network. And he recently became chair of it. And it's certainly a group that he feels has a lot of potential.
The Donegal Dublin Business Network was set up in 2017 and was the brainchild of two Letterkenny natives, Paul Doyle and Sally Ann Sherry, who were sort of the spearheads of bringing them together. And really it's about building connections between Donegal people in Dublin and those back home. So whether that's a business owner in the capital, professionals, or indeed graduates or apprenticeships, people taking apprenticeships in Dublin and starting out their career here, that we provide a platform for networking, mentoring, doing business together, and I suppose celebrating Donegal business success as well. And it opened up opportunities for Donegal business people and professionals to maintain those ties with home and create opportunities between the county and Donegal folk in Dublin.
Yeah, an interesting guy. He was involved in sort of a very important part, very important time in national media, whereby I suppose the RTE, they had the stranglehold on it. They set the agenda, they called the shots, and then you had these, you know, new guys in town. It's very hard to be RTE doing exactly what they do, right? So you have to come at it from a different approach. So he has a really interesting insight into how media very quickly evolved post the RTE dominance era recently, Chris.
Yeah, and he would have obviously worked very closely with the likes of Pat Kenny and Ivan Yates and a lot of the presenters there, and Andrea Gilligan, and a great overview of, as you say, you know, how the whole thing works and how what makes the news and how it gets to make the news. And certainly when it was a case here, we really just had one national news station for so long. So News Talk has made its mark, and he certainly played his part in that.
There was Radio Ireland before that, wasn't there?
And we had Century Radio.
Was that National Century?
I really can't
definitely
remember.
Radio Ireland was.
Century didn't last very long. No, maybe a year.
Yeah,
or so,
and it sort of News Talk got the formula that meant they compete, because obviously, for the most part, they're reliant solely on advertising. All right, interesting conversations as always, Chris. We really appreciate it. Your podcast is available right about now on our website, highlandradio.com, and it's scheduled for broadcast to on Sunday.
Sunday after the 6 o'clock.
Did it go out last Sunday?
Well, I wasn't around. So
are you okay?
I didn't check.
It did at 6. Yeah, we got
I presume
you.
It did.
Okay, it
did.
Of course it did. Caroline knows the answer to every question. You were away. Okay, did you have a nice wee break?
Great, absolutely. Super.
Chris, thanks so very much for your time. Thanks for calling in. That's Chris Ashmore. The Business Matters podcast is available for you right now on our website, highlandradio.com. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number, of course, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000. A caller says, the dead rabbit is probably down to a mink attack. A mink completely decapitates an animal when it kills it. Yeah, okay, well, that would make more sense and would be a more in line with nature explanation. Okay. No luck with that, Caroline, just at the moment. So let me see. The censorship all over is absolutely mad, says the listener. It's not just adult material getting hit in these sweeping bans. For example, in the UK, All Speak About Gaza now requires a photo ID. Threads about dealing with bullying are getting blocked. Information on LGBTQ issues getting age restricted. None of this crack is about protecting children. It's a false flag to exert more control over the population. If it was about protecting children, then parents would be signed up for mandatory internet safety courses, because if you want kids away from adult material online, it literally takes 5 minutes of your time. But God forbid any parent in this country does any kind of parenting. Sure, look at the beatings teens are giving people on the street. Sick to the teeth of lazy morons not raising their kids, and the rest of us, whether actually responsible parents or single people, have to pay for it. That is a different point of view. 086 60 25,000 if you agree or disagree. Right. Okay. Now we are joined on the phone line by Brendan O'Donoghue. Good morning to you, Brendan.
Good morning, Greg.
Brendan, of course, for the listeners' sake, as we know, is a physics teacher at St. Columba's College. And we often speak to you after some of these major earthquake events. But 8.8 is very high, and that's what we experienced off the coast of Russia, I believe. What do we know about it, and what did your equipment pick up?
Well, we know, as you say, it was an 8.8 magnitude event, which is the sixth largest event that I think has ever been recorded. So certainly it's the largest that we've recorded in St. Columba's College since the 2011, the March 2011 earthquake in Japan that caused the devastating tsunami there. So our device now is, it's amazingly small. It's about half the size of a shoebox, and it's fully digitized. So sorry, I'm a little bit out of breath.
Take your time, fully digitized.
Yeah. Now, there's actually 20 of these devices in Donegal. Since the last time I spoke to you, Greg, the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies has sponsored some of these devices to be distributed around the county. And, you know, so they're very interested in local seismicity here in Donegal. But all of these devices can pick up what we call teleseismic events, events that are big enough to send waves right across the planet's surface and through the planet. You know, it can be detected anywhere. An event of this size can be detected anywhere.
So really, so, in and of itself, your information correlates with information from many different places, be it in Donegal or elsewhere, and that's how we get such detailed information about an earthquake? Is that, in theory, how it would all work?
That's it, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, you see, what happens when an earthquake happens first, it's picked up by stations as the waves spread outwards from the source. And there's automated reporting systems for these seismometers. So what different organizations like the European Mediterranean Seismological Center or the USGS, the United States Geological Service, they collect these data automatically, and the computer generates a plot, a prediction for where the epicenter was. And as more and more data comes in from different devices, the margin of error is narrowed down, so you can tell with great accuracy in most earthquakes to within a very small area where it occurred and how deep within the planet that it occurred. So, for example, this earthquake was just off the east coast of the Kamchatka Peninsula. That's the big bit of Siberia that sticks down towards Japan. And it occurred at a depth of 21 kilometers. So it occurred where the Pacific plate is subducting or pushing below the Okhotsk plate. That's the easternmost section of, you know, it was attached to the Asian plate. And so this is an area of very large earthquakes, traditionally, or historically, I should say. So, you know, it would be just south of here where the Pacific plate subducted beneath the Asian plate that caused the 2011 event. So this region is noted for creating very large earthquakes.
And could we say that we're lucky that this happened where it did happen? Because I presume an 8.8 in a marginally or heavy populated area would have the potential for mass devastation.
It certainly would. 8.8 that close to land would be devastating, but Kamchatka seems to be very, very, very sparsely populated. And the Aleutian Islands from Alaska are very close by, and again, they are very sparsely inhabited. Now, straight away, there were tsunami warnings issued by the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. And, you know, there's links online that I went looking at this morning for the Hawaiian Islands and for the northwest coast of the United States, continental United States, looking at the sea levels. And you can actually see the wave height recorders giving the data as the sea level rises and falls with the tsunami being generated by this event. So, you know, this morning when I last looked, the first tsunami waves had reached San Francisco Bay, but the tsunami height was less than the tidal oscillation there today anyway. So you might not even have noticed if you were there. But, you know, but of course the detectors can show these spikes and show how the waves spread out all around the Pacific Basin.
Yeah. I don't want to rake over old ground with you because we have spoken to you about this in the past, but how does something half the size of a shoebox in Bala Buffet determine the difference between an earthquake thousands of miles away and other background noise potentially, Brendan?
Well, it's like a fingerprint, and, you know, each wave type, a different type of event produces a different if you like, family of waves. And an earthquake of this size produces four distinct wave sets. So when you can see those different types of wave arriving at your device, you know exactly what's happened. But it looks different on screen from a quarry blast, or if you like, from a truck passing outside the school hitting a pothole. You know, we record all of those events. So, but they all have their own distinct waveforms. And of course, the big one here is just the sheer size and duration of the waves. I mean, the ground here was shaking for over 8 hours, and that's here.
Wow.
So you can imagine how interconnected the world is when we have an event of that size. And the ground here would be moving, you know, maybe for a big event like this, over a centimeter back and forth, you know, on the other side of the Earth. But it's on such a slow cycle that you wouldn't notice it. And that's why it's not damaging when you get further and further from the event. There's just not enough energy. The ground's not shaking quick enough.
Obviously, we're in the summer holidays now, but I'd imagine this over the years has been a great way in real terms to engage with students, Brendan, because it's fascinating. It's just fascinating that you could have something here that can, you know, give useful information about an international news event happening so far away, notwithstanding, obviously, when it's a tragedy and all that side of it as well. But it must be really engaging for the students.
It is, actually, and it's something that, you know, I've been doing it now for over 15 years. And repeatedly, when events like this happen, you know, students will look at the notice board and they'll come and ask me questions about it. And I post the data up in the notice board in my room, and, you know, we post it on the school Facebook page. And you get a lot of interest from students and from parents, and indeed from local media, as you know. So it's good for the school, and it's great for the students' curiosity to know how these things actually work. And right. If you like, to emphasise our interconnectedness.
Brilliant stuff. Okay, thanks very much for that. Unless there's anything I should have asked that I didn't, Brendan, or have we touched on all the most interesting elements of this?
Hopefully. Well, the local thing, really, the real interest is the fact that there are these 20 seismometers now in Donegal. So the next Donegal event will be very interesting.
Because we'll get very good data on that, won't we?
Yeah, that's okay. The big thing.
All right, thanks very much for that, Brendan. Take care of yourself. Thank you. All right, bye-bye. That's Brendan O'Donoghue, who is a physics teacher at St. Columba's College in St. Columba's College in Ballybuffet. Astonishing. For 8 hours, he said it was registering on their equipment, a digital piece of equipment, less the size of a shoebox. But because of the fingerprint of an earthquake, they're able to distinguish it from, as he mentioned himself, someone going over a pothole or this, that, or that. It's quite fascinating. And it will be very interesting when we do have the next earthquake in Donegal, be it under Mount Errigal or some way out to sea. We'll get really, really good information about its location, depth, etc. And hopefully Brendan will be there to help us work it all out. It was all very interesting indeed. Okay, and that's still an emerging story. We don't know necessarily the ins and outs of all of it. I hope no one is seriously injured. And thankfully, there's better reporting mechanisms now for tsunamis and what have you, so people get to safety as soon as is possible. A caller says, was great to hear that somebody at long last asking why all these lovely houses are still empty, so many waiting on them, where to be allocated after Christmas last year. Thanks, Albert, for bringing it up. I believe those are the houses in Carndonagh, I'm sure. I had to travel to Longford last week and noticed that in counties Leitrim and Longford, the sides of the roads were cut and the hedges breasted, I think that it's called. Question, why is the same not done in Donegal? All back roads are narrowed down with overgrown bracken, grass and briars. Interesting observation. We'll try and dig into that a little bit further. Stay tuned. John Breslin's up next around the northwest, and then David James is live from the Mary from Dunloe Festival with a remarkable lineup of guests. But we're back with you tomorrow morning at 9. Have a great day.